Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
As you may know, I love to shop for jackets and boots this season. And when I do, I always make sure I get cash back from Rakuten. And it's not just clothing and shoes. You can get cash back from over 750 stores on electronics, travel, home decor, and more. It's super easy, and before I buy anything, I always go to Rakuten first. Join for free at Rakuten.ca, start shopping, and get your cash back sent to you by check or PayPal. Refer a friend and get cha-ching for every friend you bring. $30 for you, $30 for them. Get the Rakuten app or join at Rakuten.ca. Rakuten.ca.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 6th of May, these are our main stories. 3 years on, the World Health Organization says the COVID emergency is over. How much of a threat is it now? England's top criminal court has jailed a Nigerian senator for nearly 10 years for plotting to steal the kidney of a man he trafficked to Britain. The coronation of King Charles is just hours away. We head to the royal enthusiasts camping out to get a glimpse of it all. Also in this podcast.
For me, it's normal now. Sometimes Mary talks to me, sometimes I see her.
Why the Vatican is worried about the number of people communing with the Virgin Mary. It is the story of the decade which changed all our lives.
More than 30,000 people have died from COVID-19 in the UK. Hospital deaths.
There are more than 275,000 infections worldwide and more than 11,000 deaths. Italy crossed.
और इस समय की बड़ी खबर आपको बता दें, बड़ी खबर प्रयागराज से कोरोना को
L'épidémie de COVID-19 était peut-être pour certains d'entre vous une idée lointaine.
Now, more than 3 years since the World Health Organization announced the COVID-19 pandemic, it says it is no longer a global health emergency. The head of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said it had turned the world upside down, but that now the facts allow for a change in approach. But he also said that the threat remains considerable.
The worst thing any country could do now is to use this news as a reason to let down its guard, to dismantle the systems it has built, or to send the message to its people that COVID-19 is nothing to worry about. What this news means is that it's time for countries to transition from emergency mode to managing COVID-19 alongside other infectious diseases.
So, what does the lifting of the highest alert level mean? Our global health correspondent Naomi Grimley told us more.
Well, how it's worked is that throughout this pandemic, an emergency committee at the WHO has been looking at data. And essentially what we're talking about here is hospitalisation and death data. And over the last year, certainly what we've seen is death rates falling. Now, of course, that's because more vaccines have got out to people, 13 billion doses of vaccine given worldwide. But it's also because, of course, there's been more infections. So immunity, natural immunity has built up. And that has meant that hospitals are no longer under the kind of pressure that they were in those early days in January 2020. And for that reason, he's saying it'll no longer be an emergency phase of the pandemic. It'll be more like managing other diseases like TB, for example.
What does he mean by don't let your guard down specifically?
Well, I think he's saying that, you know, there could still be surges, regional surges, perhaps not necessarily surges that face the whole world, but there could still be surges where variants emerge. I mean, what was perhaps most striking about his statement, as well as, you know, reminding us that 20 million people probably died, was the fact that he said, I might have to put the world back into this emergency phase. And that was a kind of warning that, you know, we still don't really know enough about COVID to count out the possibility of another variant later down the line that causes more problems.
And the fear throughout this was that we have the vaccinations, but at some point you could get a new variant that would evade the vaccines and be extremely deadly at the same time. It didn't seem to happen, did it? But it could.
No, but we certainly saw, certain countries. I mean, for example, do you remember when Hong Kong had very high death rates? I mean, that was also partly to do with the way they were relaxing their restrictions. But, you know, the whole history of COVID really has been one of surprises. And of course, we had that terrible Delta variant in the middle of the pandemic from starting in India, but then spreading across the world. So what he's saying is really, you know, we've still got to be prepared. We've still got to have better vaccines because, you know, we're learning all the more now about how vaccines can target the whole of the coronavirus, not just that famous spike protein. But he's also saying, you know, countries have to be stocked properly with antivirals and other treatments to make sure they can cope with these possible surges.
Naomi Grimley. As we record this podcast, the coronation of King Charles is just hours away. Royalty and dignitaries from around the world have arrived in London ahead of the event. Many of them will be guests in Westminster Abbey when at 11 o'clock this morning the coronation ceremony will begin. Of course, there are many tens of thousands of other people who won't be in the Abbey, but who have come to the capital to soak up the atmosphere. Our colleague Johnny Diamond has been mingling with the swelling crowd.
Walk the route of procession from Westminster Abbey to Buckingham Palace. You get flags, police, tents, Black Range Rovers, police, streams of people, fold-up chairs, high-vis vests, police on motorbikes, police on horses, camera phones, sunshine, thunderclouds, and biblical rain.
Move back!
I got up at 5 o'clock this morning from Belfast, and then I got on a plane, and then I got on a train, and then I have walked to here, and I've met absolutely lovely friends.
I've got to ask, why?
Because I have the greatest admiration I had for the Queen. I admire them, I admire the work they do, and they don't get credit.
On the Mall, that huge sweep of a road that leads from Trafalgar Square to the palace, the huge Commonwealth and Union flags now hanging a little damp. Beneath, also damp, the ardent royalists camped out, who might be forgiven, even as the sunshine comes out, for having second thoughts. Did you get caught in the rain?
We did a little bit, but it doesn't take the edge off it. It's the best day ever.
No second thoughts at all?
Absolutely none at all.
Are you getting to know people in this encampment?
We've met loads of people. We've met Taylor from Canada.
Hi, Taylor. Is this part of the fun of it, in fact, is actually getting to know other people and chat with them about the coronation?
I have not experienced anything like this before in my life. Every single person is stopping to talk, to introduce themselves.
It's like a little crazy village, isn't it?
It is crazy. It's a good word.
Flags on the coronation. Cash your card.
Just before the Mall turns into the big roundabout in front of the palace, in the middle of the road there's a cluster of camera crews and a bunching of people on either side of the road. Something is about to happen. And up rolls a very large car with the royal standard on top of it. And out of it gets, if I can see anything, the King.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Congratulations.
Are you going to be arrested tomorrow?
Yeah, we're
you
very
didn't
excited.
Get too wet.
A bit.
Coming over to my side of the Mall is Prince William and Kate, Prince and Princess of Wales. What's your name, by the way?
This is Annalise. She's the same age as George.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're not staying out here, though, are you?
No, she's probably going to go home. Just the older ones.
You're amazing, brave, you guys. You blow up beds and chairs. Yeah. I don't know how you do it. The tent town that has built up along the ceremonial streets just grows and grows. These people will not be moved until the King is crowned.
That was Johnny Diamond. But not everyone is in festive coronation spirits. Some question the monarchy's relevance and grand pageantry at a time when the UK is facing its worst economic crisis in years. They sent in their messages to the BBC.
Hi, I'm Haider from London, and I oppose the monarchy because I think it's a totally outdated institution, and I think it's outrageous that The royal family is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. And most of the country right now is suffering from a cost of living crisis. It's just unbelievable what's happening in the UK right now. And the fact that this is going ahead right now at this time is utterly outrageous.
Hi, I'm Jay Varma, a filmmaker from Mumbai, India. And I'd like to congratulate all the British people for crowning the new king. But it seems a little... I'm a little uneasy about this one fact. A country which claims to be democratic, a country which claims to be secular, is again crowning a king who's going to be the head of the elected government and who's going to be the head of the church.
I'm Henry and I live in Oxford. The monarchy remains stable and it's a wonderfully dysfunctional family of real characters. It's the best soap opera in town. But is it leadership? Is it us? Is it functional? And I don't think so. I think it's a distraction from the cultural reminder of empire and the evils of empire blended rather uneasily into the benefits of Commonwealth. But you tell that to the First Nation, Canadians, Australians, etc. No, our monarchy is an anachronism. It represents stability in a changing world, but in doing its job, it papers over the need for reform while remaining incapable of reforming itself.
To some of the people there expressing their reservations about the monarchy and the coronation. In an earlier edition of this podcast, we brought you news that the head of Russia's Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, had released a video threatening to pull his fighters out of the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut, complaining of a lack of ammunition. Well, since then, Russia's defence ministry has insisted that its attack there is continuing. Russian state television has shown the defence minister ordering the troops be given all the weapons they need. So how likely are the Wagner troops to be withdrawn? A question for Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring.
We need to remember that Yevgeny Prigozhin is a bit of an attention seeker. He has been accused in the past by Western governments and various critics of disinformation and using information and manipulation in a way that benefits him. In fact, he's been sanctioned by Western governments specifically for that. So these are the reasons that make a lot of people take his threats with a bit of scepticism. The reality is, if Wagner does withdraw from Bakhmut, it's going to be really difficult for Yevgeny Prigozhin to get back into the situation where he is a key fighting force. He will have burned too many bridges.
By most accounts I've read, the Russian forces are very close to actually taking Bakhmut after many months at a great cost in terms of Russian lives and ammunition. If Prigozhin was to pull out, would the Ukrainians be able to retake, do you think?
That depends on whether the official Russian army has the resource to fill the vacuum left by Wagner. And this is very much under question because there was a reason in the first place why Russia had to rely on somebody like Prigozhin and his Wagner mercenaries to try and capture this key town. And if he goes, the Russian army might struggle and Ukraine might claim another hugely symbolic victory, previous one being Russians withdrawing from Kherson in November last year and Ukraine recapturing almost all of the Kharkiv region in the northeast. So you can't really overestimate the importance of who controls Bakhmut.
And regardless whether or not Mr. Prigozhin does pull his troops out, the relationship with Putin seems to be incredibly precarious moving forward, doesn't it?
He's not directly criticised President Putin. He has been extremely critical of his military commanders. But in terms of his relationship with Putin, it's not as clear-cut. Recently, Yevgeny Prigozhin claimed that the presidential spokesman's son served as part of Wagner, and he was very complimentary of what that person achieved. So you could see that as an attempt to build a relationship with the presidential office. So that leaves some room for continued cooperation with President Putin. He's not burning bridges there.
Vitaly Shevchenko. While infighting continues among powerful Russian players for those living in Russia, it is still hard to access information on the war in Ukraine that hasn't been state-sanctioned. Now, though, Helsingin Sanomat, a newspaper in Finland, says it's found an effective workaround using a video game popular with young Russian men to spread news, as Stephanie Prentice reports.
Players in the game Counter-Strike 2 move through a series of maps set in locations around the world, interacting with elements within each space to achieve goals like defusing a bomb or rescuing a hostage.
Maps are a fundamental pillar of Counter-Strike.
The game's makers say 4 million Russians use their platform, and these are the people Helsingin Sanomat wanted to reach to spread information about the war in Ukraine. They created a new map of a war-torn city named Dvoinya, or War in Russian, that can be accessed in multiplayer mode. When a player loses a life in that mode and they're waiting to respawn, they can roam the map as a ghost to access a hidden room. It's an underground bunker styled like a police investigation room, where the walls are covered in news articles about what's happening in Ukraine, and a voiceover informs players about mass graves and other information that Russian state media hasn't reported on. Mikko Hakkarainen worked on the project.
Currently, there are 4 pieces of news articles. One of them is an account on the grounds in Bucha, where the Russian war crimes happened last year. There's an article and an audio story about this family man from Odessa who went to grocery shopping, and meanwhile, a missile strike killed his family. Then there's a map on the Russian missile strikes that have been targeted towards civilians.
The map, which contains the articles, is currently the highest rated on the community platform. The developers say they've put the power of spreading the information into the hands of the gamers.
We hope that through players and through the gaming community, they spread the news to the Russian gamers as well, who might be then introduced to the journalism that we hit in the map.
That report was by Stephanie Prentice. Still to come on this podcast.
Almost the same experience of the fish structure in my mouth. And I'm also really amazed by the juiciness and also the kind of a buttery feel in my mouth.
A culinary first, the 3D printed ready-to-cook fish fillet.
15 years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Before being questioned, the only suspect in the case had fled the UK to Yemen. I made a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair, part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
As you may know, I love to shop for jackets and boots this season. And when I do, I always make sure I get cash back from Rakuten. And it's not just clothing and shoes. You can get cash back from over 750 stores on electronics, travel, home decor, and more. It's super easy, and before I buy anything, I always go to Rakuten first. Join for free at Rakuten.ca, start shopping, and get your cash back sent to you by check or PayPal. Refer a friend and get cha-ching for every friend you bring. $30 for you, $30 for them. Get the Rakuten app or join at Rakuten.ca. Rakuten.ca.
A wealthy Nigerian politician and his wife have been jailed for bringing a homeless man to the UK to harvest his kidney to help their sick daughter. The victim only found out what was intended when he was taken to a hospital in North London for a consultation. Senator Ike Ekweremadu, his wife Beatrice, and the doctor who helped them are the first people to be convicted of organ trafficking under Britain's modern slavery laws. Our Home Affairs correspondent Tom Simons was at the Old Bailey.
Supporters of Ike Ekweremadu had written to the court asking for leniency. As a senator, they said, he'd played an important part in Nigeria's move to democracy. But the judge, Mr. Justice Johnson, said he'd been the driving force in this conspiracy. Organ trafficking, he said, was a despicable trade which preyed on poverty, misery and desperation.
You knew that the donor was vulnerable because of his young age and his poverty. You had a profound understanding of the impact of poverty.
Ekweremadu set up charities in rural Nigeria. But as his daughter's condition worsened, he used his money to arrange a middleman, Dr. Abina Abita, to look for a donor. Abita found a 21-year-old market trader in Lagos. Detective Superintendent Andy Furphy from the Metropolitan Police Modern Slavery Team said the victim believed he was coming to the UK for work.
The suspects, who were very powerful, wealthy, incredibly politically influential, identified him, poor, homeless, living on the streets of Lagos, and trafficked him to the UK. He'd never been on an aeroplane before and had very little idea of what he was doing in the UK.
The process was only halted by concerned doctors. The young man remains in Britain, fearful of returning to Nigeria, attempting to rebuild his life. Ike Ekweremadu is facing more than 9 years in prison, his wife more than 4 years, and Abina Abita 10 years. Their victim has refused to apply for compensation from them, saying he does not want to take money from bad people.
Tom Simons. The warning from the French ecology minister was stark and straightforward. People, he said, need to get used to the fact that global warming is happening. He was speaking as the French authorities introduced new restrictions to save water, banning the sale of swimming pools in some regions, banning people from filling those they already have as well. But France isn't the only European country which has been affected by drought this year. Hence the minister's stark comments. Paul Moss is our Europe regional editor and has been taking a continent-wide look at this, starting with France.
Well, not surprisingly, the south and the southwest of the country are worst affected. But in fact, only two regions of France are thought to be totally safe from problems of water shortage. The thing is, France has had its driest winter for 60 years, but the water table there was already low. So 40 districts have been placed on alert status, four at crisis level. But bear in mind, we're only in May. The summer's yet to come, and 2,000 towns and villages in France have been told they may not have drinking water later in the year. I mean, you mentioned swimming pools. In some regions, they've already banned gardeners from watering their lawns. They've closed down car washes. You're not allowed to actually wash your own car. So all those Renaults and Citroëns will soon be covered in fine Provençal and Pyrenees dust.
What about other countries, Paul?
It's rapidly becoming a problem across Europe. By April, a quarter of Europe was warned about drought problems. Spain had a lot of attention last month, you may remember, because they had the hottest temperatures in their history. Some farmers there are saying they're not even going to bother planting their crops because they've already seen things like olive harvests ruined before they've happened. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said water's going to be one of the central political debates of our country. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because of the war in Ukraine, we've talked so much about fears about oil shortages and gas shortages, but in some regions it's actually water that's the real worry. I mean, Italy, the River Po is running low, Lake Garda is at half its normal level, and remember again, we're talking about this in early May, and scientists are warning about water shortages in Bulgaria, Poland, Romania and Greece. The problem is that the water table is already low from these high temperatures. Scientists say they need about a decade of normal or lower temperatures to get back to normal, but they're getting the opposite. They're getting higher temperatures.
Paul, remind us how we can connect all this weather with the long-term climate change.
Well, yeah, people will say, oh, well, there's always been droughts. And, there's, you know, here in Britain, people often talk about 1976, the summer then, which was sweltering. But what's happening now is continual breaking of records rather than sporadic hikes in temperature. And this is, of course, just as predicted by scientists if we carried on emitting CO2. We've just had a report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came out today. They looked at the weather in Spain and Portugal, those record-breaking temperatures, and said it could not have happened without climate change. I think what's striking about all this is, you know, you use the word drought and people think of the Sahel region of Northern Africa or perhaps of the Middle East. No, water supply issues, drought are becoming increasingly a problem here in Europe.
That was Paul Moss. The Vatican is worried about the rising number of mystics who claim to communicate with the Virgin Mary. So worried, it seems, that it's set up what it calls a task force to look into it all. Rachel Wright has more.
On Wednesday, the 3rd of May, Gisella Cardia walked up to the top of a hill in a small town near Rome, stood in front of a statue of the Madonna and entered into a trance. She claims that the Virgin Mary appears in front of her as an apparition and that the statue of Mary sheds tears of blood.
For me, it's normal now. Sometimes Mary talks to me, sometimes I see her. Sometimes she's near me. Sometimes Jesus appears in the apparitions. I know it's difficult, but I didn't ask for this.
Gisella Cardia writes down what she claims are revelations from the Virgin Mary before reading them out to the people who have gathered to hear her, which can number into the hundreds. She once claimed that the Virgin Mary was multiplying portions of pizza for her followers. According to local reports, she was convicted of fraudulent bankruptcy in Sicily 3 years before her apparitions began to appear. But the Catholic Church has not recognised her apparition and says it's worried that people like Gisella Cardia are fooling believers. So it's set up a task force to investigate the increasing number of people who claim they have a private relationship with the Virgin Mary. The head of the task force, a priest called Stefano Cecchin, says the rising number of Madonna mystics needs to be challenged because they cause confusion, promote apocalyptic scenarios, and even make accusations against the Pope and the Church. Gisella Cardia, meanwhile, says she's being unfairly stigmatised and has even been accused of prostitution. She's been ordered to remove benches, a marquee and the statue, which were all set up without permission. But locals point out that more people turn up for her monthly trances than attend Mass in the local church.
Rachel Wright. 3D printers are becoming increasingly popular. They're able to create all sorts of things, from small ornaments to even houses and buildings. But one of the newest innovations is 3D printed food. Now a team from Israel said that they've come up with a culinary first. The BBC's Tim Allman has been hearing from Eric Kaufman from Stakeholder Foods, one of the companies behind the technology.
How do you like your fish? Fried? Poached? Grilled? How about printed? Well, that's what's on offer at this laboratory in Israel. What's claimed to be the first ever ready-to-cook 3D printed fish fillet.
In the fish, the density is much lower. The flakiness is something that is much more easier to mimic. And with our patent-protected printing capabilities, we know to 3D print exactly the same texture and flakiness of a real fish. That's something that we have already a capability today of printing.
They use animal cells, cultivated and grown in a laboratory, which are then mixed with plant-based ingredients. Then the printer does its work. The manufacturers say the process is clean and transparent and they don't use antibiotics. But there is one obvious question. What does it taste like?
I'm really amazed by the juiciness and also the kind of a buttery feel in my mouth.
For now, this business is pretty small, no more than a tiddler, you might say. But the team are ambitious and hope the 3D printed version may help preserve global fish stocks. Potentially, it could make for quite a catch.
Tim Allman with that report featuring the taste buds of an expert in cell-based food, Abigail Rocheton. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chris Murphy. The producer was Rebecca Wood. The editor, Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
In 2008, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen went missing after a night out with friends in London.
I wonder what on earth could have happened.
We were so obsessed with just finding her.
Then...
Magnussen ble drepen etter å ha blitt påført...
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
I'm Noelle McHaffey, and I've been following this story since Martine was killed, making a promise to Martine's family to find out what happened and find the only suspect in the case. Farouk Abdelhak.
Leave me a message and I'll get back to you.
He's never been questioned by the police. Nobody's been able to speak to him. Until now. Murder in Mayfair. You can listen to the whole story now. Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.